Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, librarian for religious studies and theology at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Anand Vivek Taneja, assistant professor of religious studies and anthropology, about his recent book, Genealogy: Time, Islam, and Ecological Thought in the Medieval Ruins of Delhi. Anand, thanks for being willing to do this interview.
Yeah, no, thanks for inviting me to speak with you.
Great. Yeah. Your book is about a lot of things, but most of them center on Firoz Shah Kotla, the ruins of a medieval palace in Delhi that has more recently become a significant religious space in the city. So I wonder if you could start off by describing Firoz Shah Kotla. What kind of place it is, what is its history, what's it like now, and how you got involved with it.
Okay. So Firoz Shah Kotla is, as you said, it is the ruins of a medieval palace, or a fortified palace complex, I should say. So it looks like what you would imagine something old and medieval to medieval castle to look like, right? Like huge stone walls and battlements. And it's a kind of a big space. So even now, when you walk in, it encloses a lot of space and there are the ruins of lots of buildings inside. But it's kind of tumbled down and fallen apart. And most of those buildings aren't in really good shape, except for a couple, which have actually become the center of religious life. Firoz Shah Kotla is situated now. It was built originally built in the 1350s as the capital of a Sultan of Delhi, Sultan Firoz Shah Tughlaq. And so it was built at a time when the city was expanding a lot in the mid-14th century. So it had been growing for several years. So he was kind of started, in a sense, it was the center of a new urbanism at his time. But then it gradually fell into decline and was replaced by another city just to the north of it. Where it is today is very interesting because it's situated in a sense in the hinge of what are now called Old Delhi and New Delhi. Mm. So just to the north of Firoz Shah Kotla is the 17th century city, which is still surrounded by city walls, which is known as Old Delhi. And just to the south of Firoz Shah Kotla and south and west of Firoz Shah Kotla spreads out what is called New Delhi, right? Which is a city originally built by the British in the early 20th century, but built atop the ruins of much, much older spaces. Mm. And so Firoz Shah Kotla right now is kind of at the hinge of what is called the Old City, which is, in which people have been living since the 17th century, and the New City, where people have been moving mostly from the early 20th century onwards, but especially from the second half of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of serves as the interstice of these two very interesting worlds.
Right.
And you actually see people from both these worlds come into the space and interact. So
interesting. So how did you end up deciding to do work in this place?
Well, so I was a college. I was in Delhi as a college student. I moved to Delhi as a student when I was 18 after high school, and I was doing my undergraduate major was in history.
Mm.
So because of that, I started exploring all the many historical buildings in Delhi. Right, we have a built history going back at least 1,000 years, if not more, and it's one of the comparisons that's made to Delhi is. Delhi is often compared to Rome in the density of its kind of old architecture. So I started exploring all these different ruins, in chronological order on my first summer break. And I stumbled upon this place and I was like, oh, this is not just a ruin in the sense that people just go there to look at it, but there are religious rituals going on, and there are these very interesting stories that people are telling about the saints here being jinns. And I filed it away like that. It seemed to be a very curious but not something that I really wanted to think about. But then as I became more and more interested in the ways in which I became interested as I moved on from my degree to someone who lived and worked and thought about Delhi and was starting to think about PhD programs, I became very interested in how the remains of the past in Delhi were kind of continuously animated and the ways in which people kept coming back to them to make, whether for religious reasons or for more secular reasons, but how these ruins remained very much a part of the life of the city.
Mm.
And so when I started thinking about those issues, then Firoz Shah Kotla kind of became very interesting again. So I pulled it out of the of the little drawer in my head where I'd filed it, and I was like, let's go back and see what's going on here and think about it in a more critical and engaged fashion. So, right. Yeah.
Right. So you said that you started as a history major,
yeah,
undergraduate, but now you're an anthropologist.
Yeah.
So how did that happen? And how did you get specifically interested in the anthropology of religion? Maybe I had something to do with this.
Yeah. I was an history major as an undergrad, and I mm-hmm. thought that I would, have one of the things that I was thinking of was becoming a historian of medieval India. But at the same time, I got accepted into a very prestigious film program.
Mm.
And I wanted to.
Wow, okay.
So I had a choice between being a medieval historian and a filmmaker. But the film program that I was in Delhi, at a place called Jamia Millia Islamia, is very reputed. They have something called the Mass Communication Research Center, which does the equivalent of an MFA in filmmaking, but also film theory. And they specialize in, or they focus more on documentary style filmmaking. So I started making, I was trained as a documentary filmmaker, in a sense. Hmm. And one of the things that does is it makes you talk to people. So suddenly I had moved from being someone who was just interested in texts and buildings to someone who was actually interested in, talking to people and kind of, documenting their lives. And that made the switch. I think from going from a historian to an anthropologist. So when I was applying for PhD programs, and people said, well, given the range of your interests, you should be an anthropologist because that actually allows you to do all of the things you want to do. So you could be a historical anthropologist.
Right.
I never did think of myself, at least initially, as someone who works on religion. I was more interested in the ways in which people are interacting with historical buildings. But given the nature of what I've seen at this place, right? So the jinn themselves are spirits that are come out of Muslim or out of an Islamic cosmology. And I really became interested in the ways in which there was a religious articulation to everything that was going on here and the ways in which it informed people's lives. And I know you're going to ask me a question about ethics.
Right.
So I became interested
in foreshadowing.
The interaction of religion and ethics at this place. And so I think it was this site and what was going on there and paying close attention to what was going on that made me an anthropologist of religion.
Mm.
Right? Not because I chose to be one, but because my field took me there.
Well, you've mentioned jinn a couple of times, which is a nice way to move into talking specifically about your book, which is entitled Genealogy. That's Jinnealogy, which I assume is a word you've created.
Unfortunately.
And it's a reference to the jinns that populate Firoz Shah Kotla and other Muslim saint shrines, but it's also a concept that does considerable work for your overall project. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about jinns and their place in Islamic religious belief and practice, and then talk a bit about jinns at Firoz Shah Kotla and how genealogy helps you understand what this saint shrine, this medieval ruin, tells us about India.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a really, that question will take a long while to answer, I feel like.
So that's all right.
Yeah. So jinn are spirits that are, in Islamic cosmology, they're generally regarded as spirits that are made of smokeless fire and are kind of live lives parallel to human beings. We're made of clay, they're made of fire, that's kind of the thing. And they, like us, are supposed to be intelligent and be able to choose between good and evil. So they are creatures of free will, but of course they're very different from us. And the reasons that in all Islamic societies and among all varieties of Muslims, jinn are, you know, are very non-controversially supposed to exist is because they're mentioned in the Quran.
Mm.
Right. So the ways in which their existence is thought about, of course, varies widely within among Muslims, but there's no question that jinn exist. Right. So one gentleman I met once told me, well, jinn could be a reference to, you know, dinosaurs and other things, right?
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, right, because he's because he's interpreting it through a very scientific lens, right?
Right.
But by and large, if you look at the tradition there, kind of the way it's been elaborated on is that they're kind of, they can be anthropomorphic, they can change, shift shape and, you know, look like human beings or animals, and they're shapeshifters. But you can't necessarily see them. You know, human beings don't necessarily have the ability to see them because they're A, made of a different kind of substance, but they also kind of are on a cosmologically different plane, but they can choose to reveal themselves to us. And the shapes that they reveal themselves to us can be very varied. And those also include things like spirit possession, right? So, you know, throughout the Muslim world, which is not a term I like very much, but throughout places where Muslims have been historically present, all the way from Morocco in the far west to India and places further east, you have rituals of jinn possession and of intimacy with the jinns and you know, various kinds of presence of jinns, and whether it be stories or whether it be in religious rituals, jinn have always been around in Muslim societies. What is interesting and unique about the jinn at Firoz Shah Kotla is that they have become saints, right? So they're given the, and saints in Islam are usually humans, right? Sanctified human beings, not unlike Christianity. So why is it that these spirits who are, you know, definitionally not human, jinns are not ghosts, they're a completely different species of being, who are usually considered kind of fey and mischievous and a little bit troublesome, why is it that they've become saints here? You know, taken kind of this huge public role and have their own shrine in the city. And that that is actually a new development, theologically speaking. And that's what I became interested in, why that was happening in contemporary Delhi. And so I started paying attention to, and I should mention that, you know, the widespread popularity of Firoz Shah Kotla as a place which is the shrine of jinns only starts in 1977, so it's actually very recent. So I became interested in why this was happening, right? Like, what is it about the politics or the life of the city that is being reflected in this theological shift? And so I started paying attention to the stories people were telling, or the stories about jinn that were being told at Firoz Shah Kotla in particular, but also in Delhi in general. And what was interesting about all of these stories was how jinns or genies were connecting figures, human figures, centuries apart in time. So one story has the Prophet Muhammad encountering a jinn, you know, while traveling. And recognizing immediately that even though this person looks human, is a jinn. And the jinn starts, and he asks him, so you're a jinn, so tell me about yourself. And that jinn reveals that he is the grandson of Iblis, of Satan. And he has been around since the time. So he's gone through, you know, through the time of Adam and through the expulsion of Adam from, you know, paradise, and he was around when Cain killed Abel, and he goes on, and he's met all of the prophets, right, the biblical prophets. So he's met Noah, he's met Joseph, and he says, oh, and I met Moses, who told me to convey his greetings to Jesus, and I did that, and then Jesus told me to convey his greetings to you, Muhammad. And now, those are figures who are centuries, if not millennia, apart in time. So the idea that the lifetime of one jinn are like human beings, considered mortal, but they're much longer lived than human beings. The idea that jinn could bridge, and connect these figures centuries apart in time seemed to be very much part of why they were celebrated in Delhi, right? Because all of these stories, including of figures in Delhi, would allow jinn to connect people through their link directly to the Prophet or directly to figures even further back in you know, in Islamic history. Or and I became interested in why that was happening, and I saw, and I and I, then it made sense to me that this was happening in post-partition Delhi, right? So partition the partition of the Indian subcontinent of India happens in 1947, and the two separate nation states of India and Pakistan are created. And we know that there's a history of mass displacement that follows, right? Millions of people have to, many, many Muslims leave Delhi particularly, which is a city which is about 50% Muslim, and have to go to Pakistan. Many, many Hindus and Sikhs from the other side come and settle in Delhi. But so we know, we kind of know the demographic shifts, but what people don't talk about is the dramatic shift in landscapes of memory that comes along with this. So many of Delhi's Muslim saint shrines, shrines dedicated to human saints, are desecrated and abandoned, right? So in a, some sense, a whole landscape of memory is being erased, and then the post-colonial state kind of keeps contributing to this erasure as it goes along. You know, so sites are built over or destroyed or, you know, let be, partly because, you know, the Indian state, given the violence that's come with partition, doesn't want to antagonize the Hindu right wing, which really is at the forefront of all this violence. So the best way is to, you know, forget things that have happened. So it's in this kind of context where human memory, particularly Muslim memory and tied to landscape, is deeply imperiled, that you have stories of these figures who can actually connect you. When human memory becomes impossible, jinns can make these connections to figures centuries apart in time. So I became interested in that, that exactly, that what human genealogy is replaced by, in a sense, in popular theology in Delhi, by what we could call genealogy, right? So positing that the connection to the past is still possible even in this landscape of erasure. So,
I mean, time, as you've just indicated, is fairly central to your argument, and the temporality that you've just introduced about jinn sort of being living so long, providing providing some kind of connection to the far past is extremely significant. You all, you talk, so you talk about temporality with regard to jinn. You also you talk even, and you've sort of alluded to this already in what you've said. You talk about temporality more generally, and the relationship between alternate or multiple temporalities and ruins. In fact, you write, quote, ruins serve as thresholds of multiple temporalities, not just in dreams and visions, but also in ritual and cinema. In each of these modes, ruins hold open ethical potential, the possibility of transformation of current states of affairs for both individuals and communities, unquote. And as you've indicated, and as I'll do, I will talk a little bit about the ethical aspect of this. But I wanted you to talk a little bit more about temporality, because it's not just the jinn. There's there are all kinds of temporalities going on here. And what is that? What does that mean? What does that look like?
So one of the in I begin chapter two of my book with a long extract from the writer Intizar Hussain, which was actually really crucial to me to think about temporality, right? Because Intizar Hussain, who passed away, he passed away last year, and he's a major doyen of Urdu literature. And he wrote a kind of literary memoir of Delhi in the mid-2000s, so about 10, 12 years ago. And he begins the book by writing about his first visit to Delhi. So he's already moved to Pakistan. The first time he comes back, 2 or 3 years later, and he goes to a place called Nizamuddin, which is a major Sufi shrine in Delhi in the 13th century. And he describes, he talks about how for him Delhi is embodied in this lost evening, right? And And he describes that lost evening in a way which, when I thought about it, was really interesting in the ways in which he kind of was inhabiting not a singular time, but multiple times at once. Because he starts with talking about Qawwal's, you know, singers singing about the Battle of Karbala, or the presage to the Battle of Karbala, which happened in the 7th century, right? The martyrdom of Zain. Then he is talking about, that 8th century and the tragedy of that is foreshadowing or informing the way in which he is a subject coming back from briefly from his post-partition exile from a city he loves. He's already visited a poet of the 13th century, the grave of a poet from the 13th century. He walks through tall grass to visit the grave of a poet from the 19th century. And all of these, so he is constantly informed by the time of the 13th century because he knows the literature of that time. He's informed by the religious memory, we could say, of the 8th century. He's informed by the 19th century and the poet Ghalib, whose grave he visits. And also on top of that, he's talking about, the time of the monsoon, right? And he talks about the call of the peacock kind of ties it all together for him. But it's also tied to natural rhythms and to the time of the Indic ritual calendar, which is tied to, you know, agricultural time. So he manages to invoke this kind of whole layering of time in this one, in the few moments that he is kind of walking around in this very storied landscape. And to me, it struck me that actually this way of being in particular places and being able to inhabit these multiple times at once, or being informed by multiple times at once, which seems so strange to us now, was actually not that was maybe not that uncommon for someone who lived in pre-1947 India. Or even in I think one of the reasons people go to Rome or Jerusalem is because, again, you're constantly in those cities. You're never walking just in the present, right? So you're never in what Walter Benjamin would call empty, homogenous time. Your time, your present moment is constantly full of all of these potentials and resonances with the past, and people are constantly, aware of that. But it seemed to me that that is something that, post-colonial development of the city actually takes away, right? So you have, and then again, I contrast it to the story of how, now you no longer have the sense of that time. And even Intezar Hussain no longer has a sense of the time because, the shrine of Nizamuddin gets more and more crowded and more built up. So there is no escape now, or there is no sense of all these other times that one once could inhabit. That the kind of being in the present time of the city with its clamor and noise and crowds actually takes away all of those possibilities. But at Firoz Shah Kotla, which again is a place which is a 14th century ruin, but is also in some sense a little bit removed, right? Like, even though it's in the middle of the city, it's kind of this, no one really goes there. It's not a thoroughfare, so people can kind of drop out, and that's what I talk about. That people drop out of the time of the contemporary city here, and they have this sense of this, again, this kind of recovery of this sense of living in a time which is the time of the now, but also constantly layered with the presence of other times, older times. So I talk about how when people go into these ruins, they suddenly stop living with clock time, right? People are always surprised. The constant story of the first time I came here, I stopped looking at my watch, and then by the time I realized what time it's a different order of time, right? Like, you hear the call to prayer for sunset. So suddenly you're out of clock time and in ritual time. And then people talk about seeing, not only are they kind of constantly surrounded by an architecture of the 14th century, which is very different from the kinds of architecture in which people live now, but also they keep seeing visions of people from the past, right? So you have these visions, the jinns, when the people see them, the jinn saints, they dress in archaic robes. So there's this constant sense among these ruins of living with a time that is also not just the time of the present, right?
And, I mean, I hadn't really conceived of it this way, but that temporality, I you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it has some connection to ethical practice.
Yeah.
I mean, it creates certain kinds of ethical practice, I guess, or enables certain kinds of ethical practice. And as we've indicated already, ethics is central to what you're doing in this book. In the section that I quoted in the last question, you talk about the ethical potential associated with ruins. Mm-hmm. In another chapter on strangeness, you write about Gharib Nawazi. Mm-hmm. Forgive me for...
you actually got that totally right.
or the culture of hospitality to the stranger. Mm-hmm. And also about Firoz Shah Kotla and similar places as spaces where individuals can fashion themselves as ethical beings in ways that may contradict ethical norms that they're otherwise subjected to. And presumably this has some connection to the temporalities, the varying temporalities in which they're finding themselves. So how do you describe this ethics of ruins that you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a kind of two ways to do it. One is a more phenomenological one, where, you know, people like Tim Edensor, who are working on industrial ruins in Britain, also talk about, like, people go into ruins, and ruins because they're... Ruins are places where, you know, the particular ways in which space is structured by authority is crumbling away, right? So there is a way in which, you know, intentionality or the intentionality of power and the ways in which it stamps place disappears, and then ruins become places partly because they are abandoned by authority, where people do all kinds of things, right, which would be considered transgressive. Here, I think I'm trying to tell a little bit of a different story, right? Because I'm not just interested in transgression. Of course, I am, and I think we can talk about that. But a certain way of ethical refashioning, and there, here, rather than being not, I'm not just in a phenomenological conversation, but I'm also trying to think of the ways in which historians think about, you know, the ways in which we conceive of the past. So. There's a very interesting historian of medieval South Asia, Manan Ahmed Asif, who works, who's at Columbia University, who is interested in recovering, you know, past. He says that there's a way in which we read the past now as kind of inevitably leading to the present. Mm. Right? So we tend to read the history of India and Pakistan as things that would predict their outcome, right? Like, so history is always teleological because it always ends in the now. And he says that, I mean, and his idea of reading history is, I want to read history, I want to read these texts to think of the ways in which the past did not necessarily lead to the present, right? The past is actually radically different and held open radically different possibilities. So he reads a 13th century text called the Chachnama, which now is part of become the origin narrative of Pakistan, right? And he says, actually, here as a separate Muslim country, but he says, if you read the Chachnama closely as I do, what it is doing is laying out a political theory of living with difference, right? So this is actually very different from the current idea of Pakistan, and I'm trying to read that back. So I'm trying to connect the historiographic to the phenomenological argument to say that if you have a sense of the past as being radically different from the present. Mm-hmm. And if you inhabit that sense, then that allows you to think of the future as being different from the now, right? Like, not everything is overdetermined. And we see this that at the level of the individual and of communities. The most striking example of that, or the most visible example of that in Firoz Shah Kotla, is people write these letters. Mm. So people write these letters or these petitions to the jinn saints, but they also photocopy these letters and deposit multiple photocopies of them. Now, photocopying and depositing multiple photocopies is something that is, of course, the way people deal with the contemporary bureaucratic state, because you have different departments and it's all very bureaucratic, and it's, you know, the legacy of colonial governance made worse by, but what they're doing. So there is that. So it, in some ways, religious practice is echoing the ways in which people deal with the state. But it's also imagining it to be different than it is, because the kinds of things that people write about are A, very intimate, you know, the most intimate problems. And there is also the way in which they're directly, they're saying, well, the, you know, they're coming and depositing their petitions in the ruins of a 14th century palace, which in the 14th century you could do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there was this normative political theory that any person who had a problem had the possibility at least twice a week of being able to address, the sovereign directly. And that form of petitioning was known as the shikwa. So you are reviving the 14th century shikwa, combining it with a 20th century form, and you're basically imagining your entire relationship to the state not just being mediated through bureaucracy, but having this ability to directly access the sovereign. Mm. So it's what you're seeing is the possibility of the 14th century allowing you to have a very different imagination of what the state could be. Mm-hmm. Right? So not just that you always have to go through, you know, endless realms of bureaucracy before anything gets fixed.
Right.
Yeah, but also that there can be a way that, you know, you can have a direct kind of relationship to someone who will solve your
and
problem.
And the sovereign is the jinn.
In this case, it is the jinn, yeah. But it is also happening in the ruins of a medieval palace. Right. So it kind of, I read it as a form of implicit critique and kind of reimagination of what your relation to sovereignty can be.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. As you note in the book, this is all fine for men.
Yeah.
Or it seems to be all fine for men. Men are able to access this self-fashioning. It seems much more readily than women.
Mm-hmm.
But women make up what the majority of the people that come to Firoz Shahkotla.
Yeah.
So what are they finding at Firoz Shahkotla?
So that's really there are many more women than men who come here, and many of the petitions that are written, most of the petitions that are deposited, I mean, going just by the rough statistical the small statistical sample of the letters that I've read and collected at this site, I've photographed at this site. Many more women write letters than what men do. And what's really interesting about these letters is actually how much, in some sense, how transgressive they are, right? Transgressive in the sense that in the normative imagination of the Indian family, women are, you know, you're supposed to live with your, once you get married, you live with your husband and your husband's family. So, right, there's the patrilocal joint family is the normative ideal of what an Indian family should be like. So, sons stay on with the parents, daughters are married away, daughters-in-law are married in to the family, and they have to stay with their in-laws, and they basically have to take care of everyone. And of course produce progeny for the future. And yet in the letters that are deposited at Firoz Shahkotla, this normative family ideal is constantly challenged, right? Women are wishing to marry for romantic love outside the bounds of family and community, and B, they're actually asking for divorces, they're asking for husbands to move away from the joint family. So there are all kinds of ways in which what in an Indian context would be considered transgressive desires are being expressed at the site, and the saint is being asked to intercede. So things are being imagined elsewhere as they are for women, and the very fact that women can articulate their desires in this space in this very kind of forthright manner, even if no one else is supposed to read them, indicates that something very interesting is going on, right? Because this is not in all the literature and shrines that I've read in India, this is not what is supposed to happen. Right? Like, people are just not supposed to be able to express wishes like this because they're so transgressive. And yet it's happening every day. Women are writing these narratives of their own pains. They're basically autobiographical narratives of working class and lower class women in Delhi, which almost we have no access to most of the time. So yeah, so things are tougher for women, but this becomes a space where they feel much more welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also kind of try to think about it in terms of why is it that this becomes the space where this happens, right? Mm-hmm. Especially because when our usual idea of, Islamic spaces and Islamic cultures is that, they are actually, with the figure of the hijab or the veil or the niqab, that these are actually cultures that are very, I'm trying to think of the right word.
Yeah. To be careful about.
Yeah. I mean, these are patriarchal, cultures, right? That women are supposed to, there are certain limitations to the ways in which they can act and be agentive. And what we see here is actually, seems to contradict those ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of relationship that people see, that women in particular have with the saints is very anti-patriarchal, right? These are father figures, but figures of kind of unconditional intimacy who allow, in whose presence you can articulate all kinds of desires that would be considered transgressive of normative morality.
Mm-hmm.
But those are also ethical, right? So right. One of the kinds of, I'm interested in the question of, what is an? How can you be ethical, or how do we understand forms of ethics that are actually contrary to normative morality, right? Because normative morality can often be extremely patriarchal and hierarchical, and this shrine allows us to see these other possibilities of an ethics of self-fashioning, which actually goes against normativity and goes against hierarchy and patriarchy in very interesting ways.
Would it be fair to say that there are? I mean, that you describe a variety of different kinds of ethics, I think, that are available. I mean, does this lead to sort of a gendered distinction? I mean, that women are doing a kind of ethical self-fashioning in contravention of patriarchy, whereas men's ethical self-fashioning is just not really concerned with that as much?
No, I don't think so. I think it's actually interesting because, I mean, men are often as oppressed by patriarchy as women are, right? Like, I mean, they're often the beneficiaries of it, but not when you're, lower down on the totem pole.
Uh-huh.
Not before you become the patriarch, right? So, so it's interesting to me how many men come here and have theirs. I mean, it was actually easier for me to talk to the men. But the stories that men tell are often also of ways that coming to this shrine allow them to re-articulate and remake themselves, and kind of change the dynamics of their families. So there is, I think, but they often, all the men talk about coming to this place through their women. So, so this being a place where, Muslim saints are the father figures of daughters rather than sons,
mm-hmm.
definitely seems to be the kind of dominant motif here. But that doesn't mean that men don't come.
Mm-hmm.
But their association to the place is always through women.
And then you talk about their association, I mean, the men and women, the conversations that men and women have in this place is quite different from the kinds of conversations that are possible outside.
Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, given how, Delhi is a place where, and I think this has not necessarily always been the case, but even in my, two decades of knowing the city, I've felt that, women are increasingly absent from public life in the city, right? So if you walk around in the city, you will see I would say that for every 100 men, you will see in public life less than 50 women.
Wow.
Right, 50 women or thereabouts or less in most parts of the city, on public transport, in the streets, in the shops. So there is a way in which there is a kind of outside of relatively elite or spaces or like shopping malls or college campuses, you actually don't see that many women in public life. And when women are out in public, there is kind of constant presence of sexual harassment.
Mm.
So yeah, so there are certain ways in which women have to be very careful and guarded, and public life is kind of hostile to women. But within this, within Firoz Shah Kotla, A, there's a lot more women than men, and the ways in which there's a freedom and an ease with mm-hmm. which they talk to men, right, mm-hmm. about everything, right, including their lives of desire, but also theology, and there's ways in which, I kind of didn't realize this still when I was doing fieldwork, but it's later when you reflect upon how different this is from what you're seeing elsewhere, this is actually a very, very different kind of space.
Mm.
And that different kind of space is happening because of there's a certain ethics
mm-hmm.
to this place, which is being articulated through this idea of the saints being connected to as being these jinn saints being father figures of women and daughters. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked a good bit about ethics, and, mm-hmm. and ethics and religion obviously yeah. have a lot of overlaps. Yeah. But you do also reflect in this book on Islam mm-hmm. and how Firoz Shah Kotla and what you've observed there, your involvement there,
yeah.
has led you to think about Islam and religion more generally. What are some of the conclusions that you've come to?
Yeah. So I think specifically with Islam, so I was talking about how this is a space where, there's a certain kind of, women have a kind of freedom and agency to express their desire and talk and interact with men and talk about, all kind of, what by normative Indian standards would be considered transgressive. So how is this happening at this space? Is this space just, sui generis by itself, or can we trace a certain genealogy in this case of how how this comes about? And one of the things that that became clear to me doing this project was that what we are seeing here is also Islamic, right? It's not un-Islamic at all, which is what would be a critique that would be labeled against it, but that's something that you can actually find precedents for in the Islamic tradition, and that we just kind of need to broaden our idea of what the Islamic tradition is, because it contains both what we could consider more patriarchal jurisprudential traditions, but also this anti-patriarchal tradition. And so this idea that Muslim saints, particularly Muslim jinn saints, are particularly the fathers of daughters,
mm-hmm.
can actually be traced back all the way to the Prophet Muhammad, right? Whose most beloved child is his daughter Fatima, right? And through whom his lineage continues, right? Mm-hmm. The jinns in 18th century Rekhti poetry. So there's a long tradition of women's intimacy with these jinn saints, which allowed them to express their desires or at least jinn familiars in 18th century pre-modern Rekhti poetry, and in other examples we have of what jinn folklore looks like. The jinns are connected as playmates of Fatima, right? So there is a way in which there is this other whole trajectory of there being a kind of connection between the Prophet as a mm-hmm. loving father of daughters, and that allowing certain possibilities of non-normative ethics for and the expression rather than repression of desire for women, mm-hmm. right? And that goes back a long way. So what it has been interesting for me is to think of religion not just as the grounds for a certain kind of normative societal ethics, but also carrying resources within it for what looks much more like individual ethical experimentation. Mm-hmm. There's a very interesting scholar of Islam who's passed away recently, but not before writing this great book,
mm-hmm.
What is Islam? Shahab Ahmed. Who says that if you look at in the kind of academic study of Islam, there's been this huge emphasis on prescriptive ethics, right? So this is how we should, there are prescribed ways in which you should act. And he says, but if you look at the normative bulk of Islamic discourse and the Islamic tradition, prescriptive ethics have never been the norm for Islamic societies. You have much more of what we could call experimental ethics, right? So what I'm trying to say in this book is that you actually have a different genealogy and genealogy, and it often is connected to jinn, of experimental ethics.
Mm.
And that is, so my book is kind of one of a series of one in a kind of a series of new and emergent works which are thinking about experimental ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so there's also work, say, by a book that came out a few years ago by Amira Mittermeier, who's an anthropologist who works in Egypt, on dreaming.
Mm.
Right, so, you know, dreaming and the imagination and how that actually leads to a very different ethical relationship to the world, which is not coming from prescriptive ethics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So dreams and the possibility of inspiration and taking that seriously as a religious, like if you see something in a dream, and if in a dream you see something that allows you to act in ways that contradict Sharia norms,
hmm.
There is an authority to follow that dream that that doesn't, you know, that is actually has weight in mm-hmm. the Islamic tradition, and that's been the case for, you know, centuries, mm-hmm. Right? So, yeah, there are ways in which we have to kind of think about forms of authority and forms of ethics, not just as prescriptive, not just as normative. And I think, and that I think is for all religions in general, Islam in particular. And I think we need to, and my book is one of a series of new works that is kind of trying to push towards that. Yeah.
And it's also the sources that you're, I mean, you mentioned Rekti poetry,
yeah.
You use cinema. I mean, these are sources for Islamic religious practice, belief. I mean, how you traced it.
Yeah.
You were talking about how Muhammad treated his daughter.
Yeah.
And so you can find this sort of genealogy or
yeah.
genealogy, but with, might be a little bit harder to do with like a film, or
well,
or do you, is that or do some of these religious, this theology, is a grounding enough to find the grounding in a film, mm. in poetry? I mean, you
yeah.
need to go back to the Quran, you need to go back to Muhammad.
Yeah, so I'm saying that even these what we consider these you know, what I've kind of like these alternate traditions,
right.
or the genealogical as opposed to you know, the accepted genealogies of religious thought, these do go back, right?
Yeah.
Everything is going back,
everything
to the foundational texts, but the ways in which
they do it,
the ways in which they do it, and the forms of interpretation are very different.
Uh-huh.
And we just kind of need to have a more open sense of the ways in which people mm. make meaning, which is not necessarily overdetermined by, you know, prescriptive readings.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm not saying that. Yeah, there is always kind of, there's always the link.
There's always this going back,
yeah.
too, right?
Yeah.
It's just the paths,
yeah.
the ways that.
Yeah.
Okay. Ecological thought is
yes.
is significant to
yeah.
to your argument as well. So I wanted to ask you about that. Other non-human beings
yeah.
inhabit Firosha Kotla besides jinns,
yeah.
And you mentioned snakes and ants and
yeah.
kites and other creatures. What does Firosha Kotla and what do other saint shrines tell us about how humans have neglected and even abused the non-human world around us, and what kinds of ethical and religious resources do the shrines provide that,
yeah.
that show us a different way?
Thank you. That's a really good question. So, if you were to ask someone at Firosha Kotla, there are no other non-humans than the jinn, because the snake, the jinn are shapeshifters, right? So they are taking the forms of all the animals that you encounter, which makes it really interesting, because all potential animal encounters in this space are encounters with the jinn.
That's right, I remember the centipede, right?
Yeah, like the centipede, yeah. So that gives, so all animals are potentially sacred in this site and are treated as such, which is really interesting because this is a shrine in, right in the middle of Delhi, which is a city of, you know, 16 million human beings or 16 million plus human beings at this point. You know, to use a Nietzschean term, human, all too human. and it's a place of, at this point, great ecological destruction, right? So, not only do people not necessarily treat animals as well in their everyday encounters, it's just the animal encounters become increasingly harder, right? Just because there's so much... pollution, there's so much concrete, there's just like the city is you know, a place in is actually a place of great ecological destruction. So given that, to find, and the creatures that are kind of venerated at, or not venerated but treated with care at Ferozshah Kotla include animals that are not necessarily part of any, or not necessarily sanctified in any religious, or in Hindu or Muslim religious tradition in particular. Right? Dogs are, if you were to follow the prescriptive tradition, are considered unclean. But you see dogs hanging around here and being, and picking up food, and that being relatively unproblematic. Cats are treated as shrines, whereas there's no tradition of sanctity of cats. I mean, particularly not in the Indic Hindu tradition. In Islam, they're considered, you know, clean animals. So there is this connection. Snakes, as jinn snakes, do have a role in Indic religious traditions, but centipedes do not, right? Right. So the fact that you, like, an encounter with a centipede can be potentially charged with sanctity. So I became interested in why this was happening, right? Because this stands as a contrast to the ecological devastation that's happening all around. And that's why I think of what's happening in this. The figure of the jinn being shapeshifters allow for a certain kind of sanctity to the animal world at a time of great ecological devastation. In contrast to the ways in which, you know, the ways in which the landscape has been remade has actually taken away much of the sacred landscape of Delhi. Because if you, in my book, I look at 18th and 19th century accounts of what the sacred landscape of the city looked like. And it was always ecological, right? So this, all sacred sites are deeply connected to flowing water or to flowers or to, like, any description of a sacred site is actually a description of ecology, right? Or of human beings being deeply influenced by the ecological surround. So I think of the ways in which animals are being are kind of sanctified, and people build relations with them at Ferozshah Kotla as being a kind of form of ecological thought, right? Where you're forming there are forms of kinship and relations that you're forming with animals as a way of thinking beyond the paradigm of, you know, just instrumental use of the ecology that has made Delhi the city that it is, right, at this point. So, yeah, so again, so with this actually ties with the question of what do I think religion is. I think religion does allow us is not just, again, prescriptive or normative, but actually carries forms of thought and thinking of how to live better in the world, right? So,
And you push, I mean, you even push beyond non-human animals to, as you said, to water, to, I mean, to the, even stones, I mean. We're talking about a radical valuation of almost everything.
It's a very minor tradition, right? So, like, Ferozshah Kotla is not the most prominent religious site in the city, and the person who sees the shrine of the stone saint, right, which I also talk about, is also, he's just the one guy. Like, no one else around him thinks that this is particularly sacred. But I think what we have through this is a recovery of the ways in which, you know, to use Akhil Bilgrami's terms, the philosopher Akhil Bilgrami, whose work I find very important, is that there was a way of seeing the world as full of value, which he says was also part of Enlightenment thinking. It's just that that wasn't the Enlightenment thinking that dominated.
Right.
So we are kind of the inheritors of an Enlightenment which disenchanted the world, mm-hmm. In the sense of not seeing the world as full of, the material world as being full of, you know, moral value. But he said what we see at places like Firosha Kotla is kind of an attempt to recover that and to articulate that anew, mm-hmm. at a time of ecological devastation. Right. Yeah.
So I wanted to bring our conversation to a close with a huge question.
Yeah.
but maybe not too huge. It's certainly a long question, so let me go ahead and ask. This has come up just in your answer, the answer to the question I just asked you. You point out many ways in which the sacred has become disenchanted or even declared dead. You have quite a discussion about the dead and the living as far as monuments, quote-unquote, in India are categorized. And you suggest, as you've said in this conversation, many reasons for this disenchantment. You just mentioned the Enlightenment, which wasn't part of my list, but colonialism, partition, religious conflict, ecological violence. And you also point to many sources for re-enchantment, perhaps primarily the lives of those who come to Firosha Kotla, but also poetry and cinema, even the coloring of buildings. Dropping a few things for people to pick off on when they pick up the book.
Yeah.
I couldn't help but be struck by what I saw as sort of a language of duality, in the book. I think we've kind of touched on some of these things, but just to lay a few of them out, the other temporality of the jinn saints, for example, which stands in opposition to the temporality that India seems to occupy post-partition. You talk about a collective public epistemology of disenchantment versus, you don't say versus, but versus a quotidian responsive relation to the world filled with value properties, visible versus invisible religion.
Yeah.
You even use the term parallel, as in a parallel Islamic discourse accessible not only to Muslims but also to non-Muslims. And all of these dualities or parallelisms, to me, seem to be of unequal character.
Yeah.
The temporality of post-partition India seems to be in the ascendancy.
Yeah.
I mean, and you've got these little areas where you have this other temporality. So there's kind of the parallelisms that seem to be in the ascendancy always seem to be less desirable in your thinking. But there's also this suffusion of hope in your book.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of wondering, can these parallel things become perpendicular, meet one another in some way? How do you see that happening?
Yeah. I think, thank you for that question. I think that makes me think that, maybe I should have used slightly more sophisticated language in the book.
Because, well, I may have been picking out things here and there to come up with the question.
Because one thing, I think the dualities are, to me, they're not dualities. I think they're part of a spectrum, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at the Islamic tradition, for example, we're looking at there's prescriptive and then there's the non-prescriptive, I guess, the non-normative tradition that I'm pointing towards, and they look oppositional.
Mm-hmm.
But in some sense, they're not. But I think to have a complete picture of how people lived and continue to live as Muslims, you need to have both, right?
Mm.
You need to see the spectrum within which people live their lives. So it's not, for people, it's not necessarily a contradictory or oppositional relationship, which it often is in academic understandings, right? Because we are all dialecticians, right? So I would say that what I'm trying to see is that there is a certain spectrum of vision Mm-hmm. Whether it be the vision of the state or of academia or of generally of public life, where we are only seeing one kind of time, one mm-hmm. kind of tradition, right? One kind of relationship to the natural world. And I think we need to open up the spectrum. So I don't think I'm kind of... Yeah, so there's a certain kind of... I'm trying to broaden vision, right? Like I'm mm-hmm. trying to... there's an ascendancy of a certain kind of narrowing of vision, and I mm-hmm. just want to broaden it. And tied with it is the idea that there are different strands, which I think more than being parallel, which is why I said I need to use more sophisticated language, are intertwined, right? So so you have an intertwining of these different streams of thought and tradition, including the secular and the religious, mm-hmm. which we're seeing all the time, right? So there are secular conservation architects who are working to bring back to life, in a sense, buildings that were always religious in mm-hmm. their... or were not, you couldn't think of these buildings as not being religious. So there is this constant intertwining of the religious and the secular, and of, you know, different streams within of Islamic and Indic traditions, and different streams within the Islamic tradition as well, and of human and non-human lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's already there. I think we just have to kind of pay attention to it and be able to do it justice and move away from a language of duality and you know, opposition
mm-hmm.
and parallel and perpendicular, and just look at the ways in which things already exist in these complex intertwinings and be able to do some form of justice to that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, do you see, to follow up on that, do you see a way in which, for example, the other temporality of that you find in Firosha Kotla can, or perhaps it's already inhabiting in some way the way it is inhabiting the temporality of post-partition India, but it seems to be something that is. Certainly not the majority view. I mean, you can get away from the parallel, but I mean, I guess it seems like there's a value. There are valuations going on, and I think there's value in things like the other temporality that you would like to see perhaps more available more broadly.
Yeah, I think it already exists, right, as a mode of experience, right, because that is why people keep flocking to the monuments of Delhi, right, whether it be on heritage walks or guided tours and stuff. I don't think they think about it, right? Like, but why are you constantly, like, why is Bombay cinema, for example, constantly attracted to the monuments of Delhi?
Mm-hmm.
Precisely because I think they create that sense of an alternate time. Why do people? I mean, there's very interesting ways in which, and I don't think I talk about it enough in the book, but partly because it was just getting
there's a lot in this book.
Yeah, but one of the things that kind of dropped out of the book was thinking of the ways in which people, whether it be people who are conducting heritage walks and people who are kind of committed to restoring the buildings of Delhi, and, you know, people who go on these walks are all usually committed to the ways in which people relate to the past is usually about a politics of, let me put it differently, the people who are interested in having a relationship to the monuments of the past are people who are also interested in a future of plurality for India, right? Mm-hmm. Like politically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something we need, you know, so there is this way in which, and no one is, I don't think they've thought that through mm-hmm. exactly, right? Why is it that the past becomes so important for alternate visions to the future? But that remains the case. And I think that's something to think about. And that is the ways in which, you know, the time of the temporalities of the past can actually allow us to imagine and hence inhabit the future differently.
Right, so, yeah. And it's your book that's bringing this out. So, in that
hopefully,
sense,
yeah.
thank you again for this conversation.
Yeah. Thank you for a great set of questions. Yeah,
great.
Yeah.
Again, I've been talking with Anand Vivek Taneja, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies and Anthropology, about his recent book, Genealogy, Time, Islam, and Ecological Thought in the Medieval Ruins of Delhi, published by Stanford University Press as part of their South Asia in Motion series. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.